Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, I'm joined by Derek Khanna, Evan Brown, and Emery Roan. We're going to go into the FBI versus Apple dispute, look at what happened, what didn't happen, and what might happen next from Congress. We'll look at burner phones and whether they should be allowed to exist. We'll give you your weekly dose of animal selfie and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Emery Roan, episode 341, recorded April 1st, 2016. Won't someone think of the spies? This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twill. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell. Thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law. We've got had a big week and have much to discuss and have an excellent, excellent panel to do it with. All returners to the show, and we're so grateful to have them all back. Emery Roan, my co-host, is here. Hello, Emery.
Hey, Denise. I'm thrilled to be back.
Great to see you again. Congratulations. Emery has been off doing fun personal things like getting married in the off hours of the show. So we're pleased to welcome you to the ranks of married folks, and hope that all went well.
It was perfect. Thanks so much. Yeah. Couldn't have wished for a better wedding.
Good, good. Joining us again, longtime co-host of the show, good, good friend Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. It's great to be here. It's great to be back. Looking forward to rejoining the conversation.
Yeah, wonderful to see you again. For anyone who may be unfamiliar with Evan, he's a partner at Mutch Shellist in Chicago, and he writes the wonderful Internet Cases blog.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. Also joining us for a return, a too long between shows return to This Week in Law is Derek Khanna. Hello, Derek. Great to see you again.
Excited to be back on. It has been too long.
I know. Well, you're a busy guy, and so I, you know, we try and give you space before harassing you to come back for the show.
Space.
In the space we've given you between your last sojourn with us here on TWiL. You've switched coasts. You're now up in Mountain View working for Fenwick and West. How's that going?
Oh, it's been absolutely fantastic. I've enjoyed the West Coast, as we call it here, the best coast. So,
that's right. Is this the first time you've ever lived on the West Coast?
I was born in Ventura, but I lived most of my life on the East Coast. So,
got it. Well, welcome home then. Great to have you here. As I mentioned, Derek is an associate at Fenwick and West and a very prolific writer and analyst of law, tech, and policy issues. He's a former congressional staffer, has written for Forbes and many, many other outlets. What else am I forgetting, Derek?
I think that's about it. I should just mention that my comments are in a personal capacity, of course.
Yes, yes. I know what I was forgetting. Pivotal in the cell phone unlocking legislation that was passed, what, a couple of years ago now, right?
That's right. It's been a few years. We've already seen some changes in the cell phone market, so it's been exciting.
Yes, very exciting. We're going to talk about some related stuff in the show today, even. So let's get to it. We're going to start out talking about the aftermath of the FBI versus Apple case. All right. So if you're living in the United States and paying attention to news at all, then you know that the case against Apple, the order against Apple, ordering it to unlock a phone that is in at issue in the San Bernardino terrorist action, that the Justice Department would like to access to attempt to see what information is on it, that order has been vacated. And that as of today, as I understand it, the Justice Department has actually gotten into the phone. The FBI has gotten into the phone using a third party, as they told the court that they were attempting to do. And so Apple is now off the hook, does not have to unlock the phone. The order against it has been vacated. Its motion to vacate the order against it is no longer pending. There will not be a hearing on all these issues that have been in the news for the last several weeks. So it's a bit anticlimactic, but the issues at the heart of this dispute go on. And certainly the fact that there's been such a wide-ranging discussion about these issues is going to shade what happens next, whether that happens next in another court somewhere in the United States, or whether what happens next is legislation designed to address this tension between having strong encryption on devices and law enforcement and the government being able to do its job. So here we are. We know that Apple is no longer under order. We know that there's been a lot of discussion about this and that it's really just the tip of the iceberg on the issue. This is going to come up again. It has come up before. And so what we need from our lawmakers is some sort of guidance that makes sense and doesn't put courts in the position of having to order parties to do something that may well be unconstitutional, as many arguments were advanced in this case and would have been advanced had it been continued. Derek has written a great article, actually, about our constitutional drafters, our founders in the United States, and what they would have thought about this whole dispute. Derek, can you fill us in?
Sure. Well, I mean, this case brings up a lot of really interesting constitutional questions and law questions. And some commentators have argued that the law in question, which is the All Writs Act, is simply too old to be applicable. And that didn't actually make much sense to me because I said, well, the Fourth Amendment is just as old, I assume. So I started doing some research on it, and it turns out that they are basically just as old. And that when the founders passed the All Writs Act in 1789 as part of the First Judiciary Act, the very next day after Congress, after it was enacted into law, the day after it was enacted into law and signed by the president, Congress passed the Fourth Amendment the very next day. And so what I did was started to examine the history. And there's a long history in the United States of being very skeptical of these writs. In fact, Founding Father James Otis wrote about these writs as being odious and leading to tyranny. And that was really part and parcel when the founders were writing the Fourth Amendment. And so my article kind of examines this history and how the All Writs Act is actually much more circumspect than the predecessor, which was being abused by the king. And a lot of the rhetoric we've been hearing through the FBI has been that the government has some sort of a right to access any communication at any time. The idea that if there were something off limits from the government, that's dangerous and that's unprecedented. Well, the reality is that that's just – it couldn't be more false. Thomas Jefferson himself was a cryptographer. And what I discovered was that in the founding era, there were these two locks, one of them called the Brahma lock, and it was completely unpickable. And this lock existed like that from the 1770s through the 1850s. And, authorities literally could not access anything behind one of these locks. And that was the context in which they passed the All Writs Act. So with that context, it really forces us to take a different perspective on the All Writs Act. And all the law actually says is, a court can issue a writ in order to for necessary purposes. It's a very limited, circumspect piece of legislation that really shouldn't be used in the manner that was the FBI was trying to do so here.
Well, we had I'm kind of at sea as to your conclusion there, and I want you to talk through it a little bit more because weren't we also in a situation of an unpickable lock here? So why is it not similar?
No, it is similar. But in the unpickable lock in the 18th century and the 19th century, no court ordered the creator of the all-pickable lock to to go out and assemble a master key where no master key existed. But yet that's what the government was trying to do here. They're saying under this 18th century law, Apple needs to create a master key where one effectively doesn't exist. And you may say, well, it's not exactly a master key, but it's effectively the same thing as a master key. It would have enabled the FBI to access any iPhone. And that's just not consistent with the history of the law.
Right. I get what you're saying now. Emery, you've been fascinated by Derek's take. Why don't you give us your thoughts?
I mean, I don't think that I could phrase this any more eloquently than Derek did, and I really recommend that all of our listeners and viewers go out and check the blog or article, I guess, on Fenwick & West's website. I was just absolutely floored when I found out that the All Writs Act actually predated the Fourth Amendment. And, you know, I don't think I can really contribute anything that Derek hasn't already said. The fact that we had an unpickable lock for 66 years, and at no point when that lock was being used did the courts ever try to use the All Writs Act to break it. So, yeah, I'm right there with you, Derek. I think that's an excellent article, and I urge everyone to go check it out.
Thanks.
Okay, Evan, we haven't heard your thoughts on this whole Apple versus FBI saga as it's been unfolding. And I'm just, now that it has sort of wound itself down, I'd love to get your take on the whole enterprise.
Right. How fortunate am I to, you know, not be called upon to give any comments on it until we're sort of at a place of resolution, right? You know,
right.
Even though I would have had the opportunity to be prescient, you know, before, I could have just as easily been, you know, been wrong saying anything about it. So I guess no thoughtful discussion can start without saying, of course, these are critically important issues. The at a far you know, far away view, it's nothing new, this whole balance between security and privacy. We've talked about this, you know, these issues and this alignment of issues, this contrast and tension between issues many, many times under many different circumstances over the years, mm-hmm. Denise. So,
yes.
So I'll just jump, you know, particularly to talk about what Derek said and maybe extract some ideas and some notions out of that. I think it's a thoughtful piece, Derek. I like it. It's entertaining. It's creative. And it's, you know, I think you would say it's an analogy at best, because we can only compare, you know, what was going on in the technological context of the late 18th century and the ability to create locks then, and comparing that by analogy to encryption technologies today. And no analogy is perfect, or else it wouldn't be an analogy. It would just be a photocopy, right? So I'm often struck by the issue, and I sort of get hung up on the issue of whether we lead ourselves astray cognitively when we consider the idea that there truly is such a thing as an unpickable lock. And I'm using the terminology you're using, Derek, in the article, but it's unbreakable encryption, uncrackable encryption. Mm-hmm. It's something that's completely, absolutely indecipherable. And I don't know if that's actually a reality. You know, the Brahma lock and the Chubb lock later, you know, were indeed picked. And in this situation, it hasn't taken too long for the FBI to demonstrate that, because of, apparently, I think we're speculating on this, but it's the only plausible. And if Bruce Schneier says this is how it is, then I believe Bruce. Mm-hmm. I believe that that's what's real. It's an exploit of some vulnerability in Apple's encryption that caused the technology to be, I guess we would say it's been deciphered, or the encryption has been broken in this situation. So mm-hmm. when we think of it in terms of completely uncrackable encryption or an unpickable lock or whatever, I wonder if that does some disservice to us, because it appears to me that there really isn't such a thing. And the very examples that we use to try to illustrate that point show that there is not such a thing. And so when we start looking at the issue with such extremes and absolutes in mind, I worry that people's thinking gets a little bit too rigid. And for example, or just, you know, sort of fleshing this out, on one side you've got the camp that says there has to be strong encryption, there has to be the right for people to be able to communicate securely no matter what, and that should be absolutely immutably free from government influence in every way, shape, or form. No way should the government have any ability to ever soften that. And I don't think that that does us any good when we think in those absolute terms here, because there's got to be circumstances, particulars, and I like what Bill Gates had to say about this. And I know that there, you know, Bill Gates came out a day later after the USA Today piece said he was disappointed that the headline said that he was on the FBI side. I recognize there's some nuance in what Bill Gates said, but it's that whole idea that this was a very particular situation, namely some ISIS-inspired people who were trying to communicate here in an encrypted fashion. And we don't know what it says. Maybe the contents are completely, they were completely innocuous. Maybe there was nothing at all meaningful. You know, despite all this, maybe what the FBI has uncovered from Farouk's cell phone is completely innocuous. It's just like, you know, plans of where they were going to have lunch the day before the shooting. So what I'm really trying to get at here is there ought to be some workable framework that recognizes that there is no such thing as an unpickable lock, and therefore it's going to really do us any good to establish policies that assume that there will be unpickable locks, and therefore that those should be held sacrosanct. And it seems like the All Writs Act, I'm no scholar on the All Writs Act, I, you know, looked it up preparing for us to talk today, but it looks like just from the very plain text of the All Writs Act, which is at 28 U.S.C. section 1651, if anybody's interested in looking at it, it says that the federal courts can issue these writs ordering that things to be done, but it's conditioned on them being agreeable to the usages and principles of law. I look at that that qualifier, that requirement that all these things be agreeable to the usages and principles of law to give space for there to be a reasonable middle ground here, for there to be a balance struck between the interest of the government in going after terrorists and kids in, I think it's Arkansas, who shoot their grandparents or who are accused of having shot their grandparents. That I'm talking about that situation where the FBI has already helped that prosecutor down south somewhere. You know, mm-hmm. There's space within the All Writs Act for that. Even now, without what appears probably not this legislative session, probably not an election year, but it seems inevitable at some point that Congress will act on this and make some kind of legislative pronouncement about what the contours ought to be here. But until that point, I see some space here within the All Writs Act, even though it's just just a few words, for there to be a reasonable and principled middle ground that is agreeable to principles of law. What's enshrined in the Fourth Amendment.
Derek, do you draw the line between, and is it important to draw the line between what Apple was asked to do here under court order and what the FBI managed to do on its own and what it's doing since, as Evan alluded to, helping out other prosecutors who were trying to get into phones with the workaround that it now apparently has, because to me it seems to be a pretty critical line that, as Evan points out, it's going to constantly be a game of cat and mouse as far as the technology goes, whether something is truly unbreakable or not. And as computers become more and more sophisticated, algorithms get more competent at what they can do, what's unbreakable now might not be unbreakable and 5 years or less. So do you think it's important that companies not be in the position of having to break the encryption that they have created, even if someone else can do it?
I don't think anyone has a problem with the FBI finding a vulnerability and taking advantage of it to access a device. You know, the issue at hand was quite different. Was Apple was being effectively conscripted to defeat the own security in their device. Mm-hmm. That's a completely different thing. Now, as for what Evan was saying about unpickable, well, I mean, obviously there's no such thing as perpetually unpickable. No one is saying that there is. But within the article, I was talking about the idea, what they referred to at the time as unpickable locks. And the reason was is for 66 years, No one in the entire world could break into these locks. And in fact, even if you tried to break into these locks, it would actually have essentially a early self-destruct mechanism. In fact, they offered parole to people in prison if they could break through these locks. So I think 66 years is enough time to say, you know, at least for a period of time, it is unpickable. Not saying it's in, you know, as a matter of physics, impossible. I think if you couldn't get in the Apple phone for 60 years hence, we would recognize that is also unbreakable for the time being. But digital technology is different. I don't think anyone's so foolish to believe that there's no vulnerabilities in any software. You know, you see every iPhone operating system is eventually jailbroken. But what's happening here is a little bit different. And, you know, Evan just made a point about what the Al-Ritz Act says, as long as it's not contrary to the principles of law. Well, that term, principles of law, actually comes from James Otis. James Otis was complaining about the British writs of assistance, initial writs. And he called these writs, which were being abused for tyrannical power, he called them the worst instrument of arbitrary power, the most destructive of English liberty, and the fundamental principles of law that was ever found in an English law book. And James Otis, John Adams would write down a summary of that proceeding. And the Supreme Court has said that James Otis's opposition to the writs of assistance is critical to understanding the Fourth Amendment, that it directly impacted the Fourth Amendment. Mm-hmm. And so you have to put these things in context, which is, you know, yes, a court can issue a writ, absolutely. But that writ has to be limited. It's limited by the Fourth Amendment. It's limited by the Fifth Amendment. It's limited by the Ninth Amendment. There are other principles within the Constitution. And one of those principles has always been that no individual or company can be conscripted against their will to, you know, to create new software. In this case,
remind me to ask you a question about that when you're done. I don't want to interrupt you and take you off your train of thought, but I'm intrigued by that argument. But go on, Derek.
A critical aspect of this case was the reliance upon there's a case history about the Al-Ritz Act. There's a famous New York telephone case. And basically, there are a bunch of factors the court looks to. And one of them is whether or not the request is reasonable and whether or not there's a unreasonable burden upon the company being asked to do this. In the New York case, the telephone company was being required to add a intercept to their telephone network. It wasn't considered to be unreasonable. Now here the government defines the term unreasonable as only a matter of money. And so they says, we can ask any company to do anything we want, no matter how destructive it is to their market model or how onerous it is or if they have to break into their own software, as long as it doesn't cost them a significant amount of money. The problem is that that's not a principle of American law. We have this term unreasonable burden throughout American law. In one example is in the Casey example where for abortion providers, you know, you can restrict abortion as long as it's not an unreasonable burden. Well, no one's asking how much money it costs. They're saying what is reasonable. And so that's really linking back to this idea here is a court can issue a writ as long as it's not contrary to the fundamental principles of law, and that requires respecting individual liberty.
So you mentioned a bunch of amendments there that might come into play that might violate that provision in the Al-Ritz Act. But Virgil in IRC mm-hmm. brings up another one, and that's the Fifth Amendment that enables people to not incriminate themselves, not answer questions that might incriminate them in a legal proceeding. Now, in this particular case, it's not a good example for the Fifth Amendment because the person who was using the phone is deceased. But there certainly are other cases that have come up, and we've talked about on Twill before. Evan will remember going way back to Colorado Grandmothers for 500, Alex. But there certainly have been cases where people have been asked to provide assistance in accessing something that the government needs for evidence against them. And I believe we still exist in a world of flux on that, that there are some courts that say you can be compelled to provide passwords or other means to break encryption that you've locked something up with. And there are courts that say you can't because it violates the Fifth Amendment. And I'm wondering what your take on it in this encryption context is, Derek.
Well, that's actually a really interesting question. I think even the courts that are requiring people to divulge their passwords are, you know, a little uncomfortable about what they're really doing. And what's interesting here is it seems like, at least in this instance, the government had another option. So I think that's definitely going to be in the calculus of these courts, which is they may not have to go into this complicated, you know, self-incrimination question if they can get the government to unlock the phone without the person's permission. But I think, you know, normally handing over a phone is not a self-incrimination issue, but whether or not you have to provide a password is, as is, you know, there are other aspects of encrypting your hard drive and you know, if you're required to admit that there's a secret partition, those types of things can potentially be incriminating under the Fifth Amendment. But I don't think the case doctrine is clear one way or the other.
Do you think that and Evan, I'm curious to get your take on this too, any sort of Fifth Amendment argument to be made that, hey, you know, I encrypted this and that puts it off limits. That means you don't get to crack it either. I don't care what Israeli firm you contract with. You're violating my Fifth Amendment rights when you do that. Do you think that sort of argument could ever fly?
No, absolutely not. I do think there's a Fifth Amendment aspect to the Apple facts, but I don't think you have a right to have your information encrypted such that no one can ever access it. Surely if I, you know, committed a crime and had documentation with a relatively simple cipher, you know, replacing, you know, 10 for the letter G, et cetera, like that, I couldn't say, well, the government shouldn't be able to unencrypt my communication stream. It's baffling.
Right.
I don't think anyone has a right to have their information not decrypted if it's possible.
Well, that being said, though, I mean, I guess the issue is I'm still – my mind is spinning, but I'm still thinking about, we were talking about unpickable locks. And at least it's my understanding, and when we're talking about like pure cryptography and pure encryption, at that level, yeah, we can have unpickable locks, at least to the extent that our current understanding of technology allows for the ability to decrypt it. But the problem is implementation is always hard. So of course there's going to be vulnerabilities in an Apple product. They've been trying since day one to make their products unjailbreakable, but you know, they're going to be exploits. It's hard to make these products. The question though is that Apple is trying to their darndest to make an unbreakable lock. And that's what their product is, and that's what they're marketing, and that's what they're working on. And the question is whether or not the All Writs Act can compel Apple to just do exactly the opposite of what they're intending and sabotage their own products. So yeah, that's where I'm on that point. I guess I'll take that back to you guys.
Right. Evan, what do you think about the point I made? Do you think someone could ever successfully argue that, you know, I was using technology that for all intents and purposes is an unpickable lock, and I used it intentionally so to invoking my Fifth Amendment right not to be incriminated. Just as I'm not going to speak now, I'm also not going to speak through my devices. And for you to circumvent that violates my Fifth Amendment rights. Do you think that would ever fly?
I just want to make sure I'm clear on your hypothetical. And it's one of the things I get after my law student. I teach a class in law school, and I give a hypothetical, and then one of my students always raises his or her hand and say, but I want to clarify the facts. So I'm doing the exact thing to you that irritates me so much. It's like, no, I gave you a hypothetical answer to the question. But I will go ahead and do it. I mean, are you saying that in this situation, like say like Farouk survived and he would then file a motion to quash whatever information request is being issued? I don't know exactly how it would procedurally be teed up like this, where he could say that Apple would be violating his Fifth Amendment rights to decrypt the phone. Is that what you're saying? Where he assert that the Fifth Amendment violation is happening because of what somebody else is being asked to do. Is that what you're asking?
Yes, essentially. Here, you know, just use that scenario that you just came up with. Say yeah. Farouk had survived. Say we'd been through this whole rigmarole with Apple and Apple was off the hook, but the government still managed, as they have, to find a third party who could decrypt the phone and access the data. Could Farouk's lawyer, and I'm sure, you know, someone might try to do this. I'm just wondering how successful you think the argument would be, argue that my client has taken the Fifth and is not answering questions. And you are essentially end running that by decrypting his phone.
It's interesting thinking. And, you know, it's times like this when being asked to answer these questions, I wish I was a scholar on the Fifth Amendment, which I'm not. I'm not a criminal defense lawyer either. So I think about the Fifth Amendment usually when we're, you know, preparing to talk about it on Twill. But if you actually look at the text of the Fifth Amendment, it says no person shall be held to answer for an offense. And, you know, we get from that, you know, these whole extractions of what does it mean for it to be testimony and all that. I would say that I think a person would have a hard time with a Fifth Amendment argument when the conduct and the anticipated action is between other parties. They'd have a hard time asserting that their Fifth Amendment interests are being violated there because it's you're not being called upon to answer. You know, a third party is being called upon to answer on your behalf, which it would seem like those constitutional rights wouldn't port over like that. But I'm just sort of guessing, if you know what I mean.
Yes, and I'm sort of guessing that if you've taken the time to take incriminating information that was solely in your possession and not memorialized anywhere, just solely in your head, and you've written it down or otherwise memorialized it, that you've sort of created evidence that could be found by investigators. Again, none of us are criminal procedure lawyers here, and please take everything we're saying on this point with a grain of salt. We're just sort of spitballing.
Well, Denise, I kind of feel like you're positing a Fourth Amendment-like argument that it's that you have a reasonable expectation of privacy to that information because you've encrypted it.
Yes.
But that's just not how the Fifth Amendment works. And, you know, you may have a reasonable expectation of privacy to a whole bunch of things, but the government can get a warrant and vitiate that reasonable expectation of privacy to nearly anything.
Right.
And so the Fifth Amendment is really about being forced to be on the stand and say something that incriminates yourself. And if the evidence already exists, you have to turn it over. And the evidence could exist in, you know, Cyrillic or in a language that only you and your friends speak or completely encrypted in zeros and ones, and you're still forced to turn it over. And there's no rule about the government being able to translate those languages therein. And essentially, encryption is a language that your phone's able to read, you're able to access, and other people can't.
Right. Emery, I hope you're taking notes because I could certainly see this kind of a hypothetical showing up on a bar exam to come in the future. I don't know how we don't make unpickable locks our first MCLE passphrase for the show, so we're going to go ahead and do that. We put these phrases into the show in case you are watching or listening for continuing legal or other professional education credit. If you need more information about that, please go over to wiki.twit.tv, find our page there for This Week in Law, and there's a whole guide for those who are practicing lawyers who need to have legal education requirements met, a guide to who you should contact in your jurisdiction about applying to get credit for watching or listen to Twill. What were you about to say, Emery?
Oh, no, I was just talking with the chat. I didn't have anything to contribute.
Okay. Great. Well, I think we are about at the point where we could move on from talking about what has happened in the FBI versus Apple dispute and move to talking about what might happen in the Senate or the House.
Yeah.
All right. some bumpers never get old, you know?
No, they don't. That's one of my favorites. All right. So we have had a lot of talk about a proposal, a bipartisan proposal coming from Senators Feinstein and Burr on the encryption issue. I think they are close to making public a draft of their bill. Mike Masnick says that something was leaked to him. I don't know if it's the same thing, though, that he's talking about more of a commission from Representative Mike McCaul and Senator Mark Warren. All I can say with certainty is that Congress is definitely looking hard at this issue. I think that there is a draft bill at least circulating, and that they are probably focusing on exactly what Evan referenced a moment ago, trying to find some kind of reasonable middle ground between security and privacy. Derek, as someone who has actually worked on the Hill, perhaps you've been paying closer attention or have better sources than I do and can bring us up to speed here.
I actually don't have any direct sources on this one, just what I've read in the media. But this has been a kind of perennial question, which is, you know, you go back to the Clipper debates of the 90s of requiring all encrypted devices to have some sort of back channel for the government. So it seems like it's the issue du jour for every generation.
Right. Yeah. And what's your take on, I mean, we've had several technologists on the show who have told us there is no middle ground. You either have encryption that works or you have encryption that does not work. And lawmakers can talk about having some reasonable compromise position, but there is no compromise position on this. Do you think lawmakers are going to be able to deal with that absolute?
Yeah, it's a tough issue. I just think it's a bad precedent when you start having some sort of backdoor that's available for the government or weakening of protocols. Even if you trust our government, I don't trust other governments. And I think it creates a very dangerous precedent for other countries in the world. And I think we're better off as a democratic republic and liberalism as, you know, for all people, if you can communicate in private, if you can organize in private without the government listening in. And I don't think anyone's really demonstrated that there's some sort of an urgency of, terrorists using these tools to communicate. It's all been a hypothetical when the data seems to have shown that most of them are communicating in clear text or nearly clear text. Mm-hmm. So it almost seems like every terrorist incident we bring up this discussion, but that's actually not actually what they're using.
I think that's really important. I think that so frequently we're hearing the going dark argument, but this is, as many have said, this is a golden age for surveillance. I mean, the capabilities that law enforcement and government has to look into our information is greater than it's ever been before. Now, this law is this proposal is really scary because it's doing effectively what we've been saying before, that it would mandate backdoors. And they're not saying backdoors, they're just leaving it open and saying that it would require companies to sort of figure it out on what that means, but they would have to be able to access it. It's a backdoor. And again, at the end of the day, we're still talking about criminalizing math. And I mean, we're talking about, you know, theory, cryptography, you know, pure cryptography and pure encryption theoretically is out there. We know the math of how to make it done correctly and how to do it very, very well. So if we're just saying that, well, American companies cannot make these products, cannot, you know, use this knowledge that is now out there in the world, it feels like it's an unenforceable law, a bad law, criminalizing math. So I'm in the no compromise boat, but you guys knew that already.
Well, could it be that the appropriate middle ground isn't necessarily one that legislation provides, but the middle ground comes from actors like Apple in this situation, or any purveyor of a technology, more particularly any purveyor of a technology that allows data to be encrypted on the one hand, and law enforcement and the intelligence communities on the other hand? I mean, I think that there could be legislation and you know, that legislation could provide a template or a paradigm for courts to do an evaluation in a, on a case-by-case basis to see whether it would be appropriate to decrypt particular content on a particular device that is associated with a particular actor, e.g., you know, the Bernardino terrorist. Mm-hmm. Another way of doing it, though, like I said, you know, there could be more than one way of accomplishing this middle ground, setting aside the legislative one, would be reasonable, untainted by PR considerations, actions on the part of the technology companies and law enforcement intelligence communities by exerting some flexibility. I often, often, at least in the last few days, have wondered whether Apple acted so inflexibly that it put itself in a worse position than what it would have been had it cooperated on a limited basis with the FBI. Because what we see happen here is Apple refused to cooperate unequivocally for whatever reason, I think mainly PR reasons. And then the FBI found a way in. And so now the FBI has the master key to stick with our earlier analogy, and incidentally now the FBI is not willing to share its master key with Apple. So I saw a funny tweet about that, and you know, it was like app, it was like a dialogue. It was FBI to Apple, let us in.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan Zdarsky. Yeah, that was great.
Exactly. I'm sure a lot of people go screw yourself and replace the word screw with the F word. And then what is it later? FBI, we found our way in. Apple, can you let us know how? FBI, go screw yourself. So it's really kind of a funny turn of events here. And one's left to wonder whether had Apple been more cooperative and said, okay, we will create this government OS or whatever you want to call it. But as a matter of agreement with you, FBI, we're only going to allow you to use it in this situation. You could even had, I think it would have been smart to get the court's blessing in the form of some kind of agreed order with the protocols of how this is going to be done, so that the government OS would have been destroyed and it would have had no usefulness or no ability to be used in any situation other than this. And then if that had been the case, then the government wouldn't have had the same incentive to collaborate with the firm in Israel that it did collaborate with to get this done. And we would have had, in a practical sense, a middle ground having been met through cooperation, less inflexibility, more flexibility in a particular situation that wouldn't have required people bringing up things like the All Writs Act, and it wouldn't have gotten legislators all pumped up about passing new laws to address the situation. So maybe more than one way to middle ground is what I'm the heading of what I'm talking about here.
Right. And as you're talking through that, I've kind of lost my train of thought. I had a good question for you. It sort of popped out of my head again. But the middle ground of cooperation, I guess, is where I was going, without having to, it seems, at least Apple here argued that it had cooperated in all ways possible.
Obviously, it hadn't.
Drew the line at writing the government OS.
Wait a second, Evan.
Yeah.
You're saying that they're a bad actor, that they haven't, you know, obviously they haven't cooperated. You know, they've helped out the FBI with, my understanding from the public documents, is probably over 100 different iPhones in the past, without any dispute, without any problem, without any discussion. They turn over iCloud information, et cetera, upon a lawful subpoena or warrant on a regular basis. You can't even find a story of them disputing those because that's a lawful process. In this case, they were asked to do something that they couldn't do easily, that according to their own filings would take a team of a dozen people, almost a month to do. And so you're saying their failure to do that makes them a bad actor, that they didn't do everything they could have. Well, they could have compromised their software, but they believe that was a road that had never been crossed before. And a judge in New York, Judge Orenstein, just came out last month and said that is not lawful. And so I think it's appropriate for them to put their foot down at a step where they believe is beyond the pale, that has never been authorized in 227 years of the statute, and to question the validity of the order. And that's what they did there. And they said this, we believe, is to be unreasonable. How does that make them a bad actor, you know, for filling 99.9% of all requests? And then when they're ordered to degrade and destroy the security of their software, they said, we want to contest that in a court of law. They weren't saying, if you order us to do that, we're going to jail. You know, we're going to be held in contempt. That would be arguably a bad actor. They're saying, we contest the validity of this order because it's never been ordered before in an American court. And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, some of these orders are going to exist in the shadows. And so when you have a case like this that's not in the shadows because the individual involved is dead, Farouk is dead, you can ask these questions in public. And at some point, they need to be adjudicated because the precedent here is quite significant if you follow it down, a real parade of horribles. And that's what I think Apple's very worried about is, what is this doing for the next case? Whether it be, you know, an autonomous car or a web server that's hosting content that's accessed regularly by bad actors. And that's the question at hand. I don't think that makes them a – do you really think it makes them a bad actor for contesting the validity of an order?
Well, everything you said was very eloquent, and I think we all know which side you and your firm is working for. So it makes sense that you would say that. I don't think I ever used the term bad actor. I was simply taking, and nor would I characterize them as a bad actor in this situation. What I would characterize them, though, is a bit disingenuous if they're going to say that they did everything possible in their cooperation with law enforcement, as if to imply that they did everything technologically possible. And that's just clearly not true, because the FBI was indeed, you know, that's just the reality of it. The FBI was able to collaborate with an independent third party and pick the lock, and they did it in relatively short order, so to speak. And, you know, look, Apple is a company with a market cap of $600 billion. And, you know, to say that it would have been burdensome for them, you know, economically just doesn't make any sense at all. So that leaves us only with this idea that they were grandstanding from a PR standpoint, and understandably so. You know, they want their users to feel comfortable that if you're using an iPhone, you know, that your communications are private. You're not going to have the government snooping easily on what it is that you're saying. But in certain situations, I think it's unfair to say that the government should be completely blind as to what's going on. And to draw that line in the sand, this is going back to a point I was making earlier, to draw that line in the sand and have it so inflexible that under no circumstances would they be willing to cooperate with the government, actually in this case has done them a disservice, because now that technology is in the government's hands, and Apple has no control over it. Whereas had they been a little more flexible, they could have struck a deal and been able to exert a little bit more control as to how the government OS would be used. You know,
I don't see how they would have more control over the government's use of that application. I mean, had the government been able to, you know, get Apple to compromise, as you say, and, you know, been a little more flexible, then what's to say that they wouldn't be using it in the future, just like they're using the current method that they have to unlock phones, to unlock with the Arkansas prosecutor that you were talking about earlier?
Sure. Sure. Well, had Apple, you know, had the forethought to strike a deal with the government when all this was an issue and says,
then they would have sacrificed all of our privacy. I mean, a lot of us buy these phones because of the security that they're advertising. And I mean, this comes down to, again, it sounds like to me that this is an issue saying that at least your view is that companies shouldn't be able to try to build devices that are using very strong encryption, that they have to incorporate some form of backdoor, whether you're calling it a backdoor or, you know, a flexible relationship with the government. Am I mischaracterizing that?
Well, maybe I'm just not saying it real clearly. You know, what I would have envisioned Apple doing that could have served them better and would have served us all better in the sake of preserving our privacy would have been something where they struck a particular deal with the government to say, look, we will put 12 of our engineers on this. It's not going to affect our bottom line because we're a $600 billion company. We'll do this, but as a condition of this, and this could have been put into an agreed order with the court, you know, we will make you, law enforcement, promise that you won't use it in any other circumstance, in any other situation, and that after this is done, after you've gotten the data off of Farouk's phone, you won't use it anymore. You won't use it, for example, to find out what's on the phone of these kids in Arkansas who shot their grandparents without going to court again and having a judge determine in that situation. The way it's turned out now is the government has that ability to do that. And it's because it was so unequivocal on Apple's side.
In order for that to work, though, you have to toss out all of Apple's arguments that, you know, if we do this, if we backdoor the phone, then that's it. It's backdoored. And we shouldn't be forced to do that. And we've chosen not to do it. You know, that's where we've drawn the line. We have forked over all other data that we actually had access to. But we don't have access to this. And we intentionally don't have access to this. And you making us have access to this, number one, is a bad precedent, a slippery slope. Number two, violates our rights as a company to make a device that we can't access. And if you're going to access it, you're going to have to figure it out on your own.
We're in a worse situation now because that's the position that Apple took. Now the government has that ability.
I don't know why we're in a worse position. I mean, people have been writing
because
about this for months.
The government has the master key now. The government
right,
has
but
the
it's not because
key.
Of but Apple's
people,
decision.
It's because
been
Apple
writing for months
choose to
that,
cooperate. Had Apple chosen to cooperate and put tight conditions around it, I don't understand how the government would have had access to continued access to the decryption ability had Apple cooperated and made as a condition of its cooperation very strict requirements about the use of that technology, namely use only in connection with the unlocking of this particular iPhone C that belonged to the San Bernardino County or whatever health department issued to whatever his name, Farouk.
Mm-hmm. Apple's just argued all along that Tim's eyes only approach wouldn't work. And I tend to buy that there is no way to set up a sufficiently secure environment for that particular smallpox virus to exist in, that it would get out.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's what Bruce Schneier said. What Bruce Schneier said, and I totally agree with your take on, or your interpretation of what he said, was that this is an exploit that the whether it's Cellebrite or some anonymous individual or who knows what, whoever is the group of people or individual that cracked into this phone for the FBI, they were exploiting an exploit. And that exploit allows them to continue to exploit phones of the same model and operating system. So now Apple is, of course, going to try to fix that. And I'm sure that they will and would quicker had they had the FBI told them how they're exploiting their devices. But I can't buy the argument that through Apple's decision, we're now in a worse place. It's through the FBI's act of using a third party to hack this device and then not tell us how they're hacking it, that we're all put in a worse position.
I mean, Evan, you said without this, the government wouldn't be able to access the data, but technologists have been writing for months about alternative techniques to have accessed the data, namely NAND capping and NAND cloning. So there have been techniques that are available for a while. The fact that this exploit may have existed in the wild, well, there's always exploits that exist. And I think your analysis of what the government was asking was a little bit contrary to the actual facts. It's not going to be Tim Cook having this in a lock in his office. You're going to have documentation of, who wrote these programs. You're going to have people who may get called into court with writing the programs. I mean, you have to have a chain of custody in order to establish, because this is going to be used for court evidence, and Apple needs to keep track of all of that. And it's going to be used in literally hundreds of cases. You're trying to say over the course of hundreds of cases with chains of custody for all those cases and, hundreds of engineers involved and lawyers, it's impossible that this master key would lock. I think that really boggles the mind.
Well, I mean, it seems better to me, even if that's difficult, challenging or whatever, I don't see how that is worse than the situation we have now, where the government has had the motivation to develop the ability to do it without Apple's help. So You know, it's, you know, if it were a simple issue, we would have stopped talking about it long ago. So
very true. Right. You know, I think this is also,
go ahead.
Well, we can, I was just going to say that one more thing that I think is frequently not stated here is that it's, this is so disappointing that, you know, if you look in like the history of cryptography and tech, for the longest time, there was a beautiful cooperative relationship between, you know, the industry and the military and the government. And, you know, we've seen that completely shift since Snowden to the point where we are today, where the FBI has now hired an Israeli hacking firm, apparently, to hack an American device and is holding that information secret. And that only hurts all of us. So it's just a really unfortunate turn of events.
It doesn't hurt all of us, because you got to remember that the FBI actually does have a pretty important job of keeping you safe from getting blown up by ISIS. But I don't want to overdramatize it. So
it's true. It's a hard issue. And yes, people want to be safe and they want their data secure, too. We're going to talk in a moment about some of the presidential candidates' recent comments along those lines, and also a slightly related but different issue to what we've been discussing, namely the future of burner phones in the United States. But before we get there, I'd like to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is FreshBooks. If you're a freelancer or small business and feeling stressed out by stacks of receipts, spreadsheet formatting nightmares, and not enough time to deal with it all, we've got the solution you've been looking for. It's FreshBooks. Our friends at FreshBooks have created ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software that makes dealing with your taxes way less taxing. Getting started on FreshBooks couldn't be easier, even if you're not a numbers person. You can create and send invoices efficiently, plus get paid online quickly with FreshBooks payments. You also have the option to request a deposit in FreshBooks and get paid up front. No more covering costs out of pocket or waiting until the end of a project to get paid. And they've made it incredibly easy for you to track your billable time. FreshBooks recently announced their new EMV chip card-enabled card reader. This card reader is already popular with IT professionals, home computer repair and maintenance, as well as the trades. Now you can easily accept credit cards wherever business takes you, quickly and securely with their entirely redesigned iPhone app, plus create beautiful invoices in just seconds. With FreshBooks, you can focus on what you love most, growing your business. You'll wonder why you didn't start with FreshBooks sooner. Getting started is simple and is totally free for 30 days. Go to FreshBooks.com/Twill and don't forget to enter This Week in Law when they ask, how did you hear about us? Start your 30-day free trial free today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, so Representative Jackie Speier, who is perhaps your congressperson, Derek, or maybe a little bit up the 101 freeway to the north, but she is up there in Northern California. She has proposed a bill that would outlaw burner phones in the U.S. It wouldn't so much outlaw those phones themselves as require you to have an identity with that device when you purchase it, to register it, to give your ID. Do you think this is a good idea?
I don't think it's a good idea. And I think the idea of burner phones, I mean, you have a lot of other technologies that are very similar. You have iPhone apps that will scramble your phone number every time you call. So it seems difficult about how you describe a burner phone. But no, I think it's kind of silly. And also, I think people who are using burner phones have very anomalous behavior traits that the FBI can look to. You know, people who are regularly buying large number of burner phones are inherently risky. FBI is already keeping an eye on these people. I don't know why we need to require ID in order to have a phone for your car.
I don't know. They make me give ID whenever I buy antihistamines at the drugstore. So it seems like possibly a similar situation, and maybe not any more onerous to the purchaser. It certainly would be... It would dissuade people from buying, as you say, large blocks of burner phones. Maybe it would prevent them from buying large blocks of burner phones at a time, the same way you can't any longer buy Sudafed in any kind of ready way in the United States. What do you think, Evan?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of that legislation you see. I think you see it more overseas. Maybe you used to see it more in the United States. You probably see it in state legislatures from time to time that say that, you know, in order to use the internet, you have to you know, sign up and send a photocopy of your driver's license, you know, to post comments on a forum, you know, to discourage trolling or what have you like that. So, you know, that it reminds me a little bit of that, which thinks that it makes me think that it's probably more than what's needed to solve the particular problem here. And but that line of thinking gets me going down the pathway of wondering whether or not this legislation would even be constitutional. I'd like to see a First Amendment challenge to this, because, you know, the whole idea of the ability to speak anonymously is in you know, there's plenty of case law, like the McIntyre versus Ohio Election Commission case is sort of the leading Supreme Court case on the First Amendment interest one has in speaking anonymously. So it'd be interesting to see whether this would, you know, even be constitutional, because there are plenty of reasons why a person would want or need a burner phone, other than, you know, selling drugs or planning the next terrorist attack. So
sure, and I have no First Amendment right to clearly flowing sinuses. So I do think it's a distinguishable situation. What were you going to say?
You've been watching too much Breaking Bad, so we all know what you're up to, Denise.
Yes, exactly. Emery, yeah, what's your take?
You know, on the one hand, I can see how this feels like a big mallet for, like a bigger mallet than we might need. But on the other hand, this sort of legislation does not rub me nearly as badly as criminalizing encryption or requiring backdoors. And the simple fact is that, yeah, burners are used for drug deals and terrorists and sex trafficking. And, you know, the way that that operates is that they get their people to buy them on massive amounts and massive quantities. And while that is in itself risky and should be able to be unearthed from, you know, some due diligence by our LEOs, you know, I don't know. For example, going back to the San Bernardino context, you know, they definitely had their own personal cell phones. They were not the iPhones, and they destroyed those. Now, those burner phones probably did have personal communications on it. You know, I'm certainly not the person that's saying that, you know, this is the that our government is going dark and that they need this in order to stop crimes, or that even if they have this database of registered information for cell phones, that they would be able to act on it, you know, successfully to prevent anything. I don't think that we've had evidence that could even suggest that. But on the other hand, I can see more logic in this kind of legislation where, you know, just like we're talking about, if we have a problem with people making fertilizer bombs, well, you track the number of people that are purchasing large quantities of fertilizer. If you want to stop meth, you know, don't let people buy huge amounts of Sudafed. If this is something that could theoretically prevent people from buying massive amounts of burner phones, at least I can understand the purpose and the intent behind the legislation. And it seems to make more sense than, for example, attacking the civil liberties of everyone by, you know, criminalizing encryption. But I love the First Amendment argument. That is super neat. I would love to hear someone talk about that.
Oh, and I'm sure it will be made if this law is passed. Derek, what do you think about that assertion that this kind of legislation will at least addresses some of the related security concerns without outlawing encryption?
Yeah, I mean, I'm concerned about the First Amendment consequences. I'm concerned about how it leads to registration for the internet, which I think is, you know, if you're requiring people to register for burner phones, why wouldn't you require them to have an ID car before they register for the internet? It seems even much more of a strong argument, particularly when, you know, we know people are accessing the internet to download illegal content or to view child pornography or all sorts of other awful things. You can make a much stronger argument for that. And I think that's a terrible idea. I think the precedent here is what's really dangerous. And I think we need to be very careful about what we justify in the name of, you know, fighting crime. Or, you know, for example, one of the things that we could do that would be most effective at fighting crime would be to outlaw the $100 bill, because it's being used primarily in international crime syndicates. The vast majority of circulation for the $100 bill is an international crime. So, you know, why are we choosing a thing that impinges upon First Amendment liberties, but we're not going to, you know, touch the $100 bill or
cash in general, right? We're more and more moving to an economy that is not tethered to exchanging pieces of paper or metal with one another. So one could argue that cash in general is conducive to crime because it's not traceable. Bitcoin. Yes, exactly.
Much more cash is used for criminal matters than Bitcoin ever was or could hope to. But you've convinced me, Derek, I recant what I just said.
Perfect. Derek, when I think about tech policy, I tend to think of you, the marriage of the policy considerations with technology and the thinking and writing that you do on the subject. So I'm excited to have you on the show in the middle of our election cycle here to see, you know, I've only flagged in our discussion points today a couple of instances where two of the candidates, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, have mentioned tech policy in passing, both of them in the security context. I'm wondering if you look at the entire field of candidates, Derek, if you have found anyone who has an intelligent tech policy approach from your perspective.
I should just put my cards on the table that you know, I've been in communication with a number of candidates, but not Trump. I have to say that I don't think any of them have any coherent policy on technology. I think the response of the presidential candidates to the Farouk iPhone situation was quite disgraceful. They seem not to even understand the intricacies of what they were talking about, I think none of them really know what they're talking about across the board. I mean, Trump's claim of making cyber great again, it doesn't even compute. I can't.
Yeah.
Even.
Yeah. And if anyone wants to read more about that, Mike Masick has a good piece at Tech Dirt, summarizing points in an interview between Donald Trump and Maggie Haberman and David Sanger, where they were attempting to address some of his recent comments about using nuclear weapons and saying, well, don't we have a cyber arsenal that could be an alternative? And Trump's responses were kind of all over the map. And one of them was sort of, you know, we're so obsolete in cyber. We need to make cyber great again kind of thing. So, you know, I'm not sure that we can glean a cognizable policy out of that. Ted Cruz was more point blank asked at his stint at the CNN town hall a few nights ago. He was asked, as president, how will you ensure that America is not blindly attacked while also maintaining the privacy of the American people? Very in keeping with the discussion we've been having here today. And his response kind of went to, well, our intelligence community has to be more proficient at identifying bad actors and then monitoring the heck out of them, I think is what his point was there. So what do you think of that take, Derek?
I mean, some of it sounds logical that we want to mm-hmm. monitor the bad guys. I don't think anyone disagrees with that.
Right.
But you know, look at the legislation that the guy actually wrote, and you know, there weren't very many meaningful restrictions upon NSA surveillance. You know, I personally tried to meet with Senator Cruz's staff to push them on the NSA surveillance reform bill, and there doesn't seem to be very much interest in this issue as a whole. You know, they reauthorized the Dragnet surveillance programs with limited restrictions. So he says he wants to target the good guys, but he's voting for the program as a whole. So I think it's, you know, typical political pandering. And I think it's dangerous. These Dragnet surveillance programs are doing the opposite of what he's talking about. And he wants people to think that we're only surveilling the bad guys, but the programs are surveilling everyone.
All right. I'll toss it out to Evan and Emery, too. Have you seen any intelligent tech policy comments from any of the candidates that are currently running?
Well, he's got the best words, after all.
Yeah, I think Ted Cruz exhibits a fair amount of sophistication, a noble amount of sophistication in his critique of ICANN and the overall system for the governance of the DNS and the domain name system. If you just do a search for Ted Cruz ICANN, you can read about some of the very thoughtful critiques he has made, particularly with sort of this overall agenda of the Obama administration to hand over governance of the internet infrastructure to a more international community, taking it out of the sphere of influence of the United States. And so particularly with some issues of what the chairman of ICANN has done which what appears to be a little too close of a relationship with China and some of its censorship tendencies. I think Senator Cruz has done a good job of bringing those issues to light. And I think that's anybody who's considering the technology policy of any of the candidates should definitely take a look at what Senator Cruz has done, even in the busyness of running a presidential campaign, to hold ICANN's feet to the fire when it comes to those issues. So that's the most salient technology policy issue I've seen any of the candidates talk about. And it's one that often gets brushed under the rug because all into NSA surveillance and copyright and anti-piracy and all this stuff. We often forget about the basic internet governance where if that's not done well, we can't worry about any of this other stuff because we just don't have a free and open internet to enjoy.
Well, if I could jump in there, Evan, I mean, that's the easy thing for Cruz to send a letter on. That's just conservative platitudes. You know, we don't want the UN to control the internet. Okay, that's easy for any candidate. But, you know, when you actually had the big technology issue going on in the past 2 years, which is net neutrality, Ted Cruz tweeted out that it's Obamacare for the internet.
Yeah.
I mean, and that kind of shows the level of understanding of these nuanced issues. I mean, you can be for or against net neutrality, but that's the level of discussion that we've seen. You know, where is Cruz on net neutrality? He thinks it's Obamacare for the internet. Where is he on patent reform? He hasn't issued an opinion. Or copyright reform or any of these other important issues for the tech community. Where is Trump on high-skilled immigration? Well, one debate he's for it. The next debate he's against it. It's really been unfortunate. And I compare it to the last presidential cycle where every presidential candidate on the Republican side was asked about SOPA-PIPA. And every single candidate, I think it was 12 at the time, raised their hand to say they opposed SOPA-PIPA. And that was a big deal. I think that's the only technology question that I recollect seeing since the 2000 debate when they were asking about net neutrality. So it unfortunately hasn't been much coverage on these topics, but when they've had a chance, they have really dropped the ball.
Right. It is somewhat discouraging. That's why I asked the question and wanted to hash through it a bit on today's show, because I've certainly been discouraged as a voter hearing from any of the candidates on these issues. It may be that these issues get overshadowed by other things in the election cycle, and that we'll hear more about these issues from our next president, whoever that may be. But it would be nice to sort of know going in where we stand. All right. Well, Derek, you're going to have to promise me that you're going to come back on the show soon to discuss your article with Cesar Conda entitled Uber for Welfare, and go a little bit deeper into the gig economy and the welfare state and whether this is a good solution or not. Or, you know, as Evan always likes to point out, there's a lot of nuance to this particular issue. I'd love to have the time to hash through it on the show, but I just don't think we do today. I will just highlight for folks that Derek is writing about this issue and that it's pretty controversial, that, you know, the gig economy is either the bane of the existence for the American worker, or perhaps it's salvation if we think about it creatively. And I love that you're approaching it from a creative standpoint, Derek. So folks should
definitely
check out your—
definitely have to talk about that at some point.
Yeah. Folks should check out your piece at Politico and the related links I put in our discussion points at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw if you want to dig a little deeper into that. Will you come back and talk with us about this soon, Derek?
Absolutely. Look forward to it.
Okay, great. Right now, though, we're going to move into, you know, how Boing Boing likes to do a unicorn chaser after its more heady stories. We're going to do a octopus and Star Trek chaser for you here at the end of the show.
And this is when we need the animal selfie bumper. So get on it, listeners. I know you can do this. Send it
but
to me.
Now we'll settle for copyright. Yes, so we're just highlighting our weekly animal selfie. So we've had horses, we've had dogs and cats, we've certainly had monkeys, and I think we may have had octopi before. But Here's another one. stealing a video camera, swimming off with it while it's recording, and of course capturing some footage of itself. There it goes.
See, so the last time we had a squid or a cephalopod or octopus, I can't remember which one it was. The problem, the thing about that case was that it was a like a caged octopus or squid. And I think that the person actually like dropped the phone in there or like gave the phone
camera.
In there.
I think it was a GoPro.
The camera. But here you could see the octopus definitely reached out and affirmatively grabbed it.
That's a very creative drive on the part of the octopus. Is,
clear intent to capture.
Yes, the reason we keep bringing these animal selfies up is because they keep proliferating. And if you take our discussion on our last episode of This Week in Law, we should just let all this go because there's no legal issue here about whether animals have any sort of cognizable claim in copyright of pictures that they take themselves. PETA disagrees. And so that's still playing out in the courts. Also, we have a couple of great fair use stories to leave you with this week. One involves a Star Trek fan film and Paramount suing over the film is called Axanar. It's a crowdfunded Star Trek film that Paramount is claiming draws on material from the series. So this is playing out in the courts. Has anyone looked at this any more closely than I have and have anything to say about it, Evan?
Well, I mean, I read the article. I haven't looked at it independently, but, you know, it raises some interesting, you know, copyright, like sans affair issues. What are those things that can actually be appropriated to, you know, come within the scope of the subject matter of copyright, sort of that the functional aspects of things like the gold shirts and things like that. So it reminds one of some of the cases where it gets pretty metaphysical down to what is an idea and what is an expression. There was that dispute. It's probably been 10 years or so now, that dispute over the book, The Wind Ungone, you know, whether elements of a story can actually form the thing of copyrightable subject matter. So, of course, this one is intriguing because it involves Star Trek. And so we all, well, at least a lot of nerds like to appropriate those things, if only in their own minds, right?
I haven't watched Axanar yet, but apparently it has some people speaking in Klingon, which is another reason for asserting copyright infringement. Apparently, Paramount is arguing that it owns the copyright to the Klingon language. The defendants are arguing it's an idea or a system and is not copyrightable. So there are some interesting issues at play here. Derek, any thoughts?
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to watch the video. I actually thought it was really good. The production value is extremely high for fan-produced video. Not impinging all fan-produced videos, but the CGI was quite fantastic. And I think to a lot of Star Trek fans, they've been a little bit disappointed with the direction the series has been going. So it's interesting to see, you know, fans trying to reclaim the series as they see fit. Now, from a copyright perspective, you know, in these complaints, you have to boil down the individual particulates of, you know, what is similar and what are the copyrighted components. But at the end of the day, I think a judge is going to look at it and say, this is a Star Trek film. I mean, it's just obvious. Mm-hmm. It's a Star Trek film. Mm-hmm. And there are numerous cases that hold that, you know, when you have a series, another item in that series is a violation of copyright, whether it be your own Harry Potter book or your own Twilight novel or your own James Bond movie, for example, which they had to change all the characters. Now, I don't believe that that's what the law should be. I just see it as relatively clear cut. Now, we have a lot of fan fiction that exists in the world where, you know, the authors don't really take a combative tone towards it. But just because the fan fiction exists doesn't mean it's necessarily lawful. So there's two questions. One is this infringing? I think the answer is probably yes. I don't see how you can make a very obvious argument that it isn't. And then the question is, should it be? Do we actually want individuals not to be able to come up with their own, you know, movie like this? And I think there's a lot of good that comes out of this. I think the creation of this type of film to reclaim the series is a clear example of promoting the progress of the sciences and useful arts, which is what the Constitution requires. And in fact, James Madison, who wrote the text in the Constitution, himself wrote fan fiction of the most popular novels of his day. And so the idea that, you know, John Madison, when he was writing the Copyright Act to protect those novelists, was also making himself a criminal, is kind of baffles the mind. And so I think there are multiple competing interests here, and we need a world that's more tolerant of fan fiction created works, particularly as you're starting to see stuff like this where average people can really create production quality stuff.
Mm-hmm. And do we accomplish that legally, you think, through expanding the fair use doctrine or through wholesale reform of copyright law?
I think either way can do it. I think there's a few things. I think one, you need the owners of copyrighted material to be a little bit more open, which is it's generally to their benefit to have this type of thing exist in the universe, which is what you've seen to some extent with the Lucas franchise, where they allow for a lot of Star Wars related fan fiction. They're not perfect. And then the second part is fair use needs to be clearly expanded, or copyright as a whole needs to be rewritten, because this is actually a good thing for the consumer. And it's actually a good thing for the franchise, which is you're bringing new people into the Star Trek brand who are going to go out and watch the J.J. Abrams film too.
Yeah. Right. All right. Do we feel similarly about 2001, A GIF Odyssey, which is 2001, A Space Odyssey, chopped up into 569 GIFs. Now, this is obviously each GIF has its own life independent of the film, but you could watch them all sequentially and watch the film. I think that would be an incredibly painful experience, but probably possible.
I want all of them playing at once on one big screen so I can just watch the whole movie just in looping constantly.
Yeah, that's an art installation right there.
See, that would definitely be famous. I'm not sure about this specific application.
Right. Well, since you're the most likely to see this on a law school exam or the bar, Emery, what do you think?
Well, I was thinking about the Star Trek example. I mean, it feels like, at least in the Star Trek example, that it was clearly a derivative.
Good video for anyone who's watching the audio. That's why we're cracking up.
At least in the Star Trek fan film, you know, it was clearly a derivative work, and that it probably would fail the fair use test because of the fourth factor market effect. But I agree that, you know, we should probably just expand on the fair use doctrine, because allowing for the creation of derivative works is great. And if we could just allow for more derivative works, then I think a lot of the problems would be like that we wouldn't see these. So here, I think that this 2001, A GIF Odyssey, is really interesting because he's just so consciously trying to push the boundary of what the fair use doctrine covers. So I'm definitely interested in seeing how this plays out.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that I would be a little reticent to say that it's fair use, though, just because I don't really see much transformation done. I think there's probably a clear market effect. You know, if you can watch the whole thing with subtitles, then, I mean, what are you exactly doing to it? But, you know, on the other hand, an art installation where you walk into a room and they project, you know, the entire film on a single wall in the form of like 300 GIFs that are constantly looping in front of you, that, on the other hand, is extremely transformative and, you know, is an entirely different expression. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Right. I think that's going to be our second MCLE passphrase for the episode, 2001 All at Once. So we've gotten both of those in, and we've got a tip and a resource of the week to give you before we get on out of here and let you start your weekend. The tip has to do with the fact that this last week news broke that many large law firms have been hacked, and investigators are exploring whether insider trading oriented information was the target of the hack. Some very large firms, including Cravath and Weil Gotshal, were hacked. And the tip that I'm extracting out of this event, actually there are a couple of tips. Number one is that I believe there is a lawsuit that is in the works about this. I haven't looked at it too closely, but I received a PR pitch from someone who I think is gathering plaintiffs to sue over this. data breach. Yeah, exactly.
This is exactly the reason why we want unbreakable encryption.
Yes, exactly.
This is it. If all these lawyers had, you know, been communicating in good encryption, then, you know, the fact that it was hacked wouldn't matter. So,
right.
Oh, I thought you were saying that so that the ransomware could perfectly encrypt their data, and even they forget how to unencrypt it when you pay the Bitcoin ransom. That's what I thought.
Well, that's the problem with trying to criminalize it. The fact is that there will be ransomware out there that will use good cryptography that can't be broken. And, you know, so why do we want to give that capability?
Heaven forbid you should ever be able to decrypt it without paying the ransom. So anyway.
Good point, Evan.
Bad guys to stop doing that, though.
Yeah, I mean, over half of cryptography is non-American companies today. They're creating the algorithm. So anything you do for American companies is a minority of the encryption market, and an even smaller minority if you're requiring Clipper chips.
Yeah. There is a consortium for law firms, an information sharing group that disseminates information about cyber threats and other vulnerabilities. So if you're a part of a firm and your firm is not already sharing information on this topic with other firms to try and address and preempt your firm from getting hit by one of these threats, you should join this consortium. And that is the crux of our tip. And then our resource is second in a series now. Several episodes ago, we told you about Monster Cat, a label that is primarily EDM artists and adopting an interesting licensing approach. We have another one for you. It's called No Copyright Sounds, all one word. They're out of the UK. They've been around since 2011. And unlike Monster Cat, where we kind of dug into the fine print and went, oh, you know, they're presenting this as pretty lenient in their use, but yeah, there are some restrictions that you wouldn't know about unless you dug further. This one is pretty straightforward. This music is, you know, they don't bother to draft a license. They basically have one or two sentences that say you can use all of our artists' music for any use on Twitch and YouTube. Anything else, please get in touch with us. So if you are a person who, first of all, likes to listen to good EDM, this is a great catalog of stuff that you might look into. It's pretty freely available on streaming services. And secondly, if you're making videos on Twitch or YouTube, you probably already know about No Copyright Sounds. But if you don't, now you do. Wonderful chatting with you all this week, guys. It's been just a great discussion. I really, really appreciate the time. Derek Connor, great seeing you again.
Good seeing you. Thanks for having me on.
Good luck with everything at Fenwick, and please keep us posted. As I promised, we'll be back in touch soon to get you on to talk more about the gig economy and economics and all the other tech policy issues that come up day in and day out in our lives. Anything in particular you want to let us know that's going on with you or your firm before we go ahead and sign off today?
My firm's been pretty active out in Silicon Valley. As for myself, I've been working on a copyright book on copyright policy and law. So I'm trying to get peer review on that. And if anyone's interested, feel free to reach out to me. I can always use a second opinion on a few different things I'm putting together.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks. I'd love a copy personally. How about you guys?
Plus one.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
Three readers right there.
Yay. Evan, so good to see you again. Great to chat with you.
The feeling is mutual. It's a great time. Looking forward to this, getting back on. And it has not been a disappointment. And so, Derek, very nice talking with you. Always enjoy our conversations. And Emery, I don't think I said it before we went live on the stream, but I want to commend you. You're doing a great job being a co-host of Twill.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks. I got some huge shoes to fill, but I really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, Sarah was awesome. She was great.
Yes.
So go for it.
It's like the SNL 5-timers club. I'm going to have to get you all a jacket one of these days. Evan, anything going on with your firm or you that you want to highlight before we get on out of here?
Just helping clients, trying to fight the good fight, do the right thing, keep people out of trouble, help innovators and creative people, and it's fun. It's wonderful. helpful. You know, as you and I have discussed, Denise, countless times, you know, practicing law where law and technology meet is just a fascinating thing. Always something new, always something disruptive happening. So I just love being of service to my clients, and you know, it's a very rewarding thing. I guess if there's anything that's you know, I'm particularly focused on, really working on my practice with the UDRP. You know, I am a panelist for WIPO deciding domain name decisions, and I also represent clients in domain name disputes. So I've been blogging a little bit more at UDRP Tracker. That's a blog that I write about domain name disputes where the complainant loses, which happens once in a while. Why certain domain name disputes don't turn out in favor of the trademark holder or the domain name owner on that. So that's a little bit of a particularity of what I've been working on. Otherwise, life is good here in Chicago, keeping it real.
Wonderful. Derek, I promised myself I wouldn't end the show without highlighting this great tagline that Business Week gave you, saying that you advocate for startups that don't exist yet. I love that.
I do my best.
Yes.
Hopefully I win.
That's right. And that's I am fully confident that that's what Emery's going to do when he gets out of school. Emery, once again, congratulations and good luck as you finish up your second year.
Thank you. Absolutely. Really appreciate it. Fridays are a treat every week. So happy to be here.
They are. All right. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us. We do record the show on Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. We hope you can tune in and join us live, but don't worry if you can't. You can always find our shows at twit.tv/twill, along with instructions on how you can enjoy the show at your leisure on any device that you please, whether it's a big screen or a little tiny one, whether it uses strong encryption or not. You can enjoy the show however you'd like by going to twit.tv/twill. Look for us on YouTube as well, in iTunes, et cetera, et cetera. And between the shows, you should definitely get in touch. I'm Denise at twit.tv. You can find me at D Howell on Twitter. The show has a Facebook page and a Google Plus page. Also great places to get in touch between the shows. Let us know what you've thought about what we've discussed, any further things it made you think about, anything you want to add, any guests you'd like to suggest or topics. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next week on This Week in Law.